The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thanks. So a short story from 2016 tells the story of Rogelio, a young boy in a detention center in San Diego, separated from his parents by an ornate gold wall built by a not-so-fictional president who has had scenes from his life carved into the gaudy monstrosity. Children are permitted to wave goodbye to their parents for 30 seconds through soundproof plexiglass before they are shuttled away beyond the Great Wall back to Mexico. The author writes about his motivations for writing the story in a recent op-ed aptly titled "The Dystopia Is Here," saying he had hoped it would sound a warning about what our country could become if no one stood up to Mr. Trump. But he writes, "I am sickened to admit that my dystopian tale has come true." Indeed, the vision of the state putting children in cages while the press silences their cameras so we don't hear them scream is one of the most dystopian images the Trump presidency has foisted onto our new reality. The Twitterverse was awash with debates about just how many steps from Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale we are in a world of border checkpoints, child abductions, and Supreme Court-sanctioned discrimination against Muslims. The same week featured a timely episode of The Handmaid's Tale in which the protagonist, June or Offred, is briefly allowed to see her daughter who was abducted by the fictional state of Gilead, only to be ripped away from her again as she grapples with the impact of this trauma on her daughter, who doesn't understand why her parents haven't come for her. That week also marked what would have been the 71st birthday of science fiction pioneer, the great Octavia Butler, whose work particularly, yes, if there's one thing we get from this talk, if you haven't read her work, you should. The dystopian Parable of the Sower and its sequel, The Parable of Talents, have gained renewed interest since Trump's election. Seven Stories Press announced that it had sold out of Parable of the Sower, and I'll talk more about her and her novels, but it's worth noting that among the many atrocities Butler depicts in her dystopia, one of the most gut-wrenching is the forced removal of children from parents deemed heathens who are placed in camps or homes of members of the Church of Christian America while their parents are placed into re-education camps. How many people, Butler's protagonist Lauren wonders, can be penned up and tormented before it begins to matter to the majority of Americans? And how does this penning people look to other countries? And I think the protests last Saturday and the international outpouring of solidarity for separated families begin to answer that question. A starting point for Marxist discussions of art is Trotsky's famous formulation that a work of art should in the first place be judged by its own law, that is, by the law of art. But Marxism alone can explain why and how a given tendency in art has originated in a given period of history. In other words, who it was who made a demand for such an artistic form and not for another, and why. But it's not actually right now only Marxists who understand the appeal of this form today, even if many of the most widely read dystopian fictions currently emerge from previous historical periods. If anything, the question is dystopian fiction the social realism of the 21st century? Countless articles have raised this question with titles like How to Live in a Dystopian Fiction, or Why Dystopian Fiction is an Instruction Manual for Now. The past year has seen a renewed interest in older works of dystopian fiction, and the immense popularity of TV shows like The Handmaid's Tale and Westworld, movies like Ready Player One and Fahrenheit 451, and a whole new field of dystopian fiction in the making. At the same time, a genre of alternate histories has become increasingly popular, novels, movies, and TV shows that take actual historical moments and imagine different outcomes or events. Particularly two time periods dominate in this genre, World War II, the historical moment when the world seemed closest to fascist control, and the Civil War and the history of chattel slavery in America, a crucial history to understand the centrality of racism to this country's inception. I'd originally planned on talking a little bit more about those, which I'm not going to have time to, but I think quickly to say the television series based on Philip K. Dick's 1962, The Man in the High Castle, which imagines a history in which Nazis won the war, Colson Whitehead's Pulitzer Prize-winning Underground Railroad, which reimagines the history of slave resistance as a physical railroad whose stops reveal different variations on this the virulent racist history of this country, Ben Winter's Underground Airlines. In addition, novels like Casey Lehman's Long Division, which goes between 2013, 1985, and 1964, and Octavia Butler's 1979 novel Kindred, which was reissued last year as a graphic novel and shuttles between 1976, The Bicentennial, and The Antebellum South. Both of these novels particularly use time travel to draw parallels between the racism of the present and the institutionalized racism of the plantation and the Klan on which this country was founded. These genres share, I think, similar features on drawing on the worst abuses of human history, totalitarianism, racism, and sexism, slavery, to discuss the present. Handmaid's Tale is as much about history as it is about a dystopian future. It Can't Happen Here, which this talk draws its title from, is both an alternate history and dystopian fiction. Meanwhile, things like Underground Airlines, a novel that imagines a United States in which the Civil War never happened, is as dystopian as anything Orwell, Huxley, or Butler wrote. But I'm hoping that this discussion here won't just focus on how bad things are. In fact, I think one of the most important features of these works is not the sense of gloom and doom they project, but that they focus on the contingent in history, i.e. what could be different in the past, present, or future based on human actions and struggle, whether historically or in our present and near future. And that's because both genres emerge in response to moments of political crisis, when people look for answers as to how we got here and what we can do about it. These questions lead us inevitably to think about the past, what could have happened differently, and to the future and what we can do differently. And so no matter how bleak, they speak to the possibility of a different history, a different present, and a different future that ultimately hinges on what we do, on struggle. So I'm going to argue that they're not necessarily pessimistic or cynical. In fact, they show that struggle always exists and reminds us that while there are no guarantees, our actions can change the course of history and shape a future society that doesn't have to look anything like this one. And so I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about a few examples of this, not necessarily even the best of the best, but certain novels and TV shows that I think have been used as kind of a lens to understand the present and kind of capture the current political imagination. I want to make one quick caveat that I'm actually not going to talk much about young adult dystopian fiction. There was an excellent talk about that a couple years ago. But I would just say as a quick side note, I think that anybody who's been paying attention to young adult dystopian fiction would not be surprised by the new movement of Students Against Violence that has emerged in the aftermath of the Parkland shooting. For a generation that has never lived in a country not at war and racked by economic crisis, a country that now has the highest youth mortality among 19 other comparable countries in the OECD, it's not surprising that they're drawn to novels with young heroes and heroines, most often gender nonconforming ones, who are fighting to transform the dystopian world bequeathed to them by adults. Just as an example, the characters of Ready Player One, for example, are in the third decade of a Great Recession, even as fast food joints, we're told, have a 2-year waiting list for applicants. And it includes an important character, spoiler alert for people haven't read or seen the movie, despite using an avatar of a white man, is actually a young black woman whose father died in Afghanistan, was raised by a single mother, and was kicked out of her home when she came out. So while the blockbuster kind of success of movies like Hunger Games had actually waned a little bit pre-2016, I think that nightmare that is Trump led to an astonishing resurgent interest. In addition to Handmaid's Tale and Parable of the Sower, the Trump era has seen increased sales of Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, Fahrenheit 451, Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, and George Orwell's 1984, which saw an increase in sale of 9,500% post-inauguration. Trump can't take all the credit in 1984's boost in sales. The spectacle of Sean Spicer's press conferences helped. And Kellyanne Conway deserves special mention here, as her invocation of alternative facts sounds like it came straight out of the Ministry of Truth, where Winston, the protagonist of 1984, works, altering the news to create a historical record consistent with whatever his fictional dictator Big Brother says that day. Never one to miss a political bandwagon she can jump on, Hillary Clinton invoked 1984 in her memoir, What Happened, about how everyone but her is responsible for her loss. If he, Trump, stood up tomorrow, she writes, and declared that the earth is flat, his counselor Kellyanne Conway might go on Fox News and defend it as an alternative fact, and too many people would believe it. A valid point. But then her reading veers to the bizarre. Quote, attempting to define reality as a core fiction feature of authoritarianism, she explains, quote, the goal is to make you question logic and reason and to sow mistrust towards exactly the people we need to rely on, our leaders, the press, experts who seek to guide public policy based on evidence, ourselves. Now, we might agree that ourselves is part of that, but I think that anyone who's read Orwell and Orwell himself might, the idea that somehow 1984 is about why we need to trust leaders, the press, and people who make public policy seems hard to square with the novel's pretty strong argument to the contrary. But it's also somewhat to say that politicians are not above stealing ideas from dystopia. Margaret Atwood has expressed concerns that The Handmaid's Tale might be used as a rulebook for Mike Pence. If this seems doomsday, it wouldn't be the first time that dystopian novels are used as policy. The term meritocracy, a term almost synonymous with modern defenses of inequality under capitalism, actually comes from a 1958 dystopian novel called The Rise of the Meritocracy. It's written in the form of a dissertation, which means it's not great reading, even if politically fascinating. And in fact, one publisher initially rejected it, saying that they don't publish dissertations, somehow didn't notice that, one, it was satirical, and B, it was set in 2034. Central to the novel is an explanation, though, of how the educational system was transformed to create a system in which, quote, IQ plus effort equals merit, and the creation of a new, quote, meritocracy that has superseded the old aristocracy of birth and plutocracy of wealth. A new educational system is thus essential, one in which people are tracked based on IQ tests. And frankly, parts of the book read like a handbook for 20th and 21st century education reform. And it's worth noting just quickly that some of the few opponents of the use of these tests are socialists, so right on that front too. But when that means when Fareed Zakaria, as he recently did in the Washington Post, writes that the meritocracy is under attack in response to attempts to change selective admission policies for New York City selective enrollment schools, he's actually defending a dystopian world. It's like saying Gilead or Oceania are under attack. It wasn't meant to be something we aspire to. So dystopian fiction has been around for quite some time. It was originally coined in the 1740s, arising primarily in response to utopian works that were popular at the end of the 19th century. It means an unhappy country. Many of the first ones were in response to socialist utopian novels like Edward Bellamy's 1888, Looking Backward. And it often had politics hostile to socialism with titles like Looking Further Backward. But it wasn't until the first half of the 20th century that the genre really exploded onto the literary scene, emerging really from the experiences of World War I, labor struggles, and the experience of socialist struggles and revolutions, most notably, of course, the Bolshevik Revolution and the Stalinist counter-revolution. Some of the more famous ones in this period, Yevgeny Zamyatin's 1924 We, Huxley's 1935 Brave New World, and George Orwell's 1984, among the most famous. I'm not going to spend much time on these novels. I think it's important to think about their political context, though, particularly since they're read primarily as a critique of Stalinism, even though I'd argue they satirize and critique Western capitalist societies at least as much, if not more. And there's a reason that Orwell sets 1984 in England, or Airstrip 1, not the Soviet Union, the Eurasia of the novel. 1984 in particular is grim reading and provides little hope for resistance to Big Brother's control of Oceania, but I think for a socialist like Orwell living in post-World War II world after the rise of fascism, the Holocaust, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and of course the Stalinist counter-revolution that betrayed everything he and the revolution once stood for, it's understandable why things might look a little bleak. Sinclair Lewis's 1935 novel, It Can't Happen Here, which came out the same year as Brave New World, is now being advertised as the novel that foreshadowed Donald Trump's authoritarian appeal. And it's easy to see why the novel has such strong appeal. Set in the Depression era, its depiction of Berzelius Buzz Windrip, a demagogue running for president based on his simultaneous appeal to the Depression era League of Forgotten Men and businessmen alike, he resonates with today's resurgence of right-wing populism, even as he's firmly rooted in the Democratic Party and seeks to co-opt the rhetoric of both left and right, promising redistribution of wealth while winking at the business owners and promising not to take their money away. After winning the primary against FDR, he launches a campaign of virulent immigrant bashing, racism, sexism, and anti-Semitism. Among his 15 points of victory for the forgotten men are government control of all finance and labor unions, a commission to study $5,000 cash payments to families, prohibitions on African Americans voting, women working outside of the home, and anyone advocating socialism. The chilling depiction of his violent band of Minutemen who function as a private armed militia is also resonant in the post-Charlottesville moment. He also has his own Steve Bannon in the form of the terrifying Lee Sorensen, the mastermind behind his political treatise, Zero Hour. Despite many a New England liberal declaring that it can't happen here, Buzz Windrip wins the election when Congress protests. It's notable that one reviewer notes that only in fiction does Congress actually do anything. He then declares martial law, ushering in what he calls a corporatist regime with corpo government, corpo theology, etc. He maintains control with the violent Minutemen. He establishes mass concentration camps and brutalizes anyone who resists. And the novel is unbelievably prescient in the sense, even though I don't actually like that term for these works, and we'll explain why in a second, but it depicts mass concentration camps before the reality of Auschwitz and Dachau were internationally known. And I think it's being reread in a moment when there's a growing international threat of right-wing nationalists, self-proclaimed fascists, and Nazis explains part of this appeal. I think another aspect of the novel's current appeal lies in its protagonist, Dorismus Jessup, an old liberal from Vermont, a small-town newspaper publisher who uses his publication to agitate against Winthrop and who is frequently called a communist and a radical, even though he himself is clear that he is an entrenched liberal and not radical at all. Lewis writes, far from being a left-wing radical, he was at most a mild, rather indolent, and somewhat sentimental liberal, as little of a Bolshevik as Herbert Hoover. He becomes, though, the unlikely embodiment of the resistance, pushed to the left by political circumstances, forced to even work with the communists he despises, and ultimately joins a resistance movement that's led by Senator Walt Trowbridge, the lesser evil Republican opponent to Winthrop in the presidential elections. May sound familiar. A major target of the novel is liberal complacency and American exceptionalism, the "it can't happen here" sense that the title captures. This can at times border on moralism or cynicism about the American populace more broadly, but its clearer targets are primarily wealthy liberals and intellectuals who are comfortable in their own status and blind to the larger political and economic crisis until after it's happened. One of these men declares pre-Winthrop's election, "That couldn't happen here in America, not possibly. We are a country of free men." While the novel was inspired by the rise of fascism in Germany, it also captures something about a particularly American brand of rabid right-wing authoritarianism masking under the guise of populist rhetoric and dog-whistle politics. And this is where I think we have to understand this, that Sinclair Lewis wasn't so much prescient as he was observant. He didn't predict Trump. He recognized the political and historical context which could make his politics appealing. This is true of dystopian fiction more generally. It does not predict the future so much as comment on the atrocities of past and present. As one critic notes, it becomes clear that the groundwork for fascism has already been constructed. The response to the claim that it can't happen here is it already has. Certainly in a country built on slavery, it's not hard to imagine the need for a new underground railroad to Canada, nor is it hard to point out the absolute absurdity of the idea that it can't happen here because we're a country of free men. We are nothing of the sort. Ben H. Winters makes this point when discussing his novel Underground Airlines, which imagines the United States in which the Civil War never happened. Slavery still continues in the quote hard four, only neoliberalized and Taylorized and enshrined within the Constitution. Asked about his novel, he said it really wasn't that difficult to imagine a United States where pro football teams stock rosters with slave labor. Free states have checkpoints where black drivers are routinely pulled over to check their papers and make sure they're not escaped slaves, and free blacks live in poor freedmen's towns with shadowy Klan-like right-wing pro-slavery groups and liberal politicians who claim to shun slave labor but ultimately let the market prevail. Child abductions in dystopian fiction are common, for example, in all of these works because of the atrocious constant in the history of a country founded on slavery and genocide. Ripping the mask off of America, home of the free, is what I think Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here does best. Scenes of liberal intellectuals and elites marveling at the possibility of Winthrop's election remind me of an SNL, a Saturday Night Live skit that aired shortly after Trump's election. People might see him with Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock at an election night viewing party where everyone else is absolutely certain Trump can't win, something many of us thought, and go through various levels of shock as the returns come in. At one point, Cecily Strong's character says, "Oh my God, I think America is racist." To which Chappelle replies sarcastically, "Oh my God, you know, I remember my great-grandfather told me something like that. He was like a slave or something." And a few seconds later, Beck Bennett says, "This is the most shameful thing America has ever done." And the expressions on Chappelle and Chris Rock's face serve to remind us that this isn't even close. The history of shameful things this country has done is too long to list. Capitalism, Marx writes, comes into the world dripping from head to toe from every pore with blood and dirt, creating, as Josiah Henson, the escaped slave who was the inspiration of Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, wrote, quote, "a truth stranger than fiction." Perhaps no dystopian writer captures that history more evocatively and powerfully than Octavia Butler, particularly in The Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents. These books were supposed to be part of a trilogy, which The Parable of the Trickster was supposed to be the third one of, was published at Butler's untimely death in 2006. She's a writer whose talent and political and artistic legacy cannot be underestimated. One of the few African-American women science fiction writers in a field dominated by white men, she was also the first science fiction writer to be awarded the MacArthur Genius Grant. She's often credited as a founding voice of Afrofuturism, even though she didn't use that term herself. And she was raised by a single mother in Pasadena who worked cleaning the houses of predominantly white people and was deeply impacted by the racism she saw her endure. Her political outlook was also shaped by the Black Power movement she encountered in college, where she took the first class her college ever offered in Black literature, a transformative experience. And her work, I think, purposely kind of eludes classification in one specific genre. This year has seen both Rodentius and Kindred, which I already mentioned, and then Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents. Gloria Steinem writes the novel, "There's one thing scarier than a dystopian novel about the future. It's one written in the past that has already begun to come true." And a colleague noted that by the time they teach it in the fall, it may be more accurate to call it documentary rather than science fiction. In the not-so-distant world of California 2024 to 2027, Parable of the Sower introduces us to an apocalyptic world brought about by climate change. Drug abuse epidemics are fanned by pharmaceutical companies. Water and food scarcity have made social and economic inequality all the more extreme. Violence is everywhere as people who still have homes hide behind walls to protect the little they have against those who have even less, and against raving bands of people addicted to a drug called pyro that makes them love fire and burn down everything in pursuit of a high. The protagonist, Lauren Olamina, a young woman growing up in this world, is a hyper-empath due to a drug her mother took while pregnant, and is in constant danger because she feels the pain of everyone around her, a crippling disability in this world. Most of the novel is a bleak tale of her struggle to survive in a world seemingly hell-bent against it, as her family is murdered, her home burned, and she is forced to travel by foot in search of a home further north and to start a community based on a rational religion she creates called Earthseed, a kind of spiritual belief for atheists and space enthusiasts, which argues that God is change and that humanity's future is in the stars. Parable of the Talents pick up where the first novel leaves off, with the creation and destruction of the first Earthseed community and its growth as it begins to fulfill the potential its founder envisioned. It doesn't take much to see where Butler got the idea of this kind of post-apocalyptic world decimated by environmental disaster and the resulting social and political upheaval. While Butler at times objected to political readings of her work because of she saw that there's frequently attribution of political content to Black writers solely because of their race, she also explicitly cites political motivations for writing Kindred, Wildseed, and the Xenogenesis trilogy, the latter inspired by Ronald Reagan. She wrote, quote, "The only thing he inspired in me that I actually approve of." The Parable series, she explained, was inspired by the news. She explains, "I considered drugs and the effects of drugs on the children of drug addicts. I looked at the growing rich-poor gap, at throwaway labor, at our willingness to build and fill prisons, and our reluctance to build and repair schools and libraries, and at our assault on the environment." A quick aside, I think the devastating impact of drugs is a recurrent theme in Butler's Parable novels and other dystopian fiction, and I think resonate particularly in the current moment with the opioid crisis. Lauren's mother dies of drug abuse, just as the mother of the protagonist in Ready Player One. In Parable of the Talents, people are addicted to dream masks that take one away from the world. In Brave New World, people are similarly addicted to a hallucinogenic drug called Soma, which kills the mother of one of its main characters. It's perhaps not surprising for a writer politicizing the Black Power movement that the police and law enforcement in these novels are at best incompetent and usually significant part of the problem. They charge fees to investigate anything and usually make any problem worse, harassing people for carrying guns, for example, in a world where it is unsafe to be unarmed, or planting evidence to, quote, solve cases, including Lauren Olamina, to wonder what a badge is other than a license to steal. Butler demonstrates absolutely no faith in capitalism, the electoral system, or politicians. Neither politicians nor business leaders will provide solutions, she explains, because, quote, "politicians are short-term thinkers, opportunists, sometimes with consciences, but opportunists nevertheless. Business people are hungry for profit, short and long-term." In the first book, the candidate some look to for change is Donner, who vows to abolish science programs and suspend overly restrictive minimum wage, environmental, and worker protection laws. Quote, "bread and circuses," one character says at the elections. "Politicians and big corporations get the bread, and we get the circuses." As a result, whole towns are privatized by individual companies, modern versions of the old company town, which traps people into debt slavery. It's interesting to note that there's a similar insight in Ready Player One with corporations advertising, quote, "indentured servitude, your fast track from debt to success." These company towns and Butler's work promise security and some education, just enough to educate the next generation of workers in a world where violence is everywhere, literacy is deteriorating, and public education decimated so that the few public schools that do exist, quote, had more in common with city jails. Slavery is brought back, particularly sexual slavery, as people are forced into it with shock collars that control them. It's a bleak vision, but not unbelievable. She saw her first book, Parable of the Sower, as a novel about problems, and the second one, even more eerily relevant today than the first, as a novel of, quote, solutions, not the ones she proposes, but the ones people turn to in times of crisis. And here's where we get the character of Texas Senator Andrew Steele Jarrett, associated with the Church of Christian America, who runs on a campaign slogan, and I kid you not, is Make America Great Again. And to many dismay, he wins in 2032. He is associated with a violent gang of bigots called the Crusaders, who kill and burn witches and other heathens to enslave them in re-education camps, abducts their children, and sends them to be raised by Christian American families. It's worth noting that Butler didn't predict Trump, nor did Trump take his slogan from her novel. It was used by Ronald Reagan first, a campaign Butler was well aware of. And what Butler says about Jared, she says, Jared can come to power in, quote, post-pox, i.e. post-apocalypse America, because, quote, hunting for scapegoats is popular in times of serious trouble, so is hunting for the great leader who will restore prosperity and stability. And unhappily for Jared's followers, they do find such a leader. Because of him, innocent people lose their freedom, lose custody of their children, and lose their lives. Sounds familiar. Despite the bleak vision of post-pox America, it's also a story of resistance and change. As Olumide's search for solidarity and her survival because she is able to build a multiracial egalitarian community in a world that seems to preclude it and does its best to destroy it. This is the heart of Earthseed. While spiritual in nature, it's based on a rational assessment of society, prioritizes education above all else, including project-based, child-centered education, and is premised on the need for collective solidarity to survive. And Butler repeatedly brings up the question of public education in interviews about some of her motivation. This comes up in a lot of other works as well. I think the novel Feed, which has schools transformed into schools TM under COVID control. But she was also horrified by efforts in California to deny undocumented immigrants access to education and healthcare. So Earthseed is really the antithesis of all of this. Lauren's commitment to this community and the future it represents is not without its costs, and her daughter blames her abduction on her mother's commitment to this cause over her own safety. Asked about this, Butler recalled Viola Leoza, a white woman who lost her life in the struggle for civil rights. She remembers letters written to a women's magazine that said she had no right to deprive her husband of a wife, her children of a mother, and that her duty was to look after her own family, not be involved in a struggle that was not her own. Butler notes, it's interesting that not one of those letters writers condemned her murderers. They only condemned her. Again, very resonant in the current moment. Butler's work here and all in her novels refuses right-wing family values and in fact rejects the nuclear family altogether, as she again and again posits collective multiracial communities organized based on solidarity and collective survival, not genetics. Her characters, mostly strong women, are usually gender non-conforming and sexually fluid. Lauren passes for a man for much of the novel, and this is true in many of her other novels. And while she has some cynicism about humanity, it's this belief in the malleability and potential for genuine solidarity and liberation that animates her work. As she writes in the parable, the human species can do something not other animal species has ever had the option to do. We can choose. We can go on building and destroying until we either destroy ourselves or destroy the ability of our world to sustain us, or we can make something more of ourselves. Our new worlds will remake us as we remake them. And the novel ends with a hope for future, but one that would remain unrealized. While Butler wrote hundreds of drafts of the sequels, which was supposed to be a third novel set in space where the Earthseed community tries to rebuild, she struggled to find an ending to her trilogy. As one researcher explained, she ultimately decided that she would need to write 4 more books, he says, because that would be how long it would take, in Butler's estimation, for the human being of the future to become capable of working towards a common decency. She saw hope, but a long way off. But I do think it's that hope that is part of her appeal. Butler's work is notable for both what it shares with the work of other contemporaries, particularly Margaret Atwood of Handmaid's Tale, and in terms of gender and sexuality and right-wing political zealots, and where it departs, most notably around questions of race, which is a notable blind spot of Atwood's. Atwood's Handmaid's Tale has had more than any of the other books seen popularization in the current period, largely because of the television series. Probably many people have seen it, yes? Yeah. Okay, so you know the premise. Fictional Gilead, which in what is now Boston, a fictional regime come to power after a massive fertility crisis in which all women, including ruling class women, are forbidden from reading or writing. People are deemed killed for being sex traitors. People are sent to the colonies to clean nuclear waste until they die. Women who are fertile and have violated any of these Gilead's repressive laws are forced to be handmaids for the wealthy, meaning they are raped regularly in what is known as the ceremony. If they do conceive, the child is taken away from them and they are sent to a new assignment. And the novel follows one such handmaid, June or Offred, they're all named after the commanders they serve. And when the series was in the works, I think before the 2016 election, it's taken an entirely new meaning after the election, with a serial sexual assaulter in the White House and in the Me Too moment. The immense violence, which is often grueling to watch, speaks to a moment in which the U.S., while far from Gilead's daily ritualized and state-sanctioned brutality, has been ranked for the first time among the top 10 nations deemed most dangerous for women. Among the other top are India, Afghanistan, Syria, Somalia, and Saudi Arabia. At the same time, as people may have seen, there's now a new movement of self-described trad wives, or traditional wives, including one who recently launched a, quote, white baby challenge in response to the perceived decline of fertility of the Western world, and you can't make this stuff up. It's also benefited from some incredible political timing that are almost eerie. The scene I already mentioned with Offred and June with her daughter that dealt with the trauma of forced family separation, but also recently, I think, an interesting episode at the same time as Trump was battling it out with leaders internationally, the fictional leaders of Gilead were negotiating in Canada in one of, I think, one of the better episodes in an otherwise uninspired season. While Gilead, we can talk about that more later, while Gilead is eventually kicked out of Canada after letters from the regime's victims are made public, leading to some major wish fulfillment if only the U.S. was kicked out of the international talks for its oppressive policies. But earlier scenes in which you have leaders of the so-called free world discussing possible extradition deals and willing to negotiate with rapists, murderers, and child abductors is nauseating and all too real. The scenes of refugees, survivors of the regime, and family members of Gilead's victims protesting was both inspiring and devastating. And I think it's worth noting that in the book, we learn in an epilogue that Canada was often not safe for refugees because they did round up and extradite refugees so as not to antagonize their neighbors. Like Butler, Atwood was deeply impacted by the right-wing assault. And while it's another one, again, that's deemed kind of prescient, she makes it very clear that it wasn't, that she actually didn't take anything that wasn't from history. She wrote, having been born in 1939 and come to consciousness during World War II, I knew that established orders could vanish overnight. Change could also be as fast as lighting. It can't happen here, could not be depended on. Anything could happen anywhere. And I think one of the things that's most brilliant about the television show is that it updates the political frame of reference from the 80s to now. So it offered the flashbacks from Gilead shows a world we all know, and despite the brutality and violence, I think I agree with Leela, who wrote a great review of the show, its most terrifying scenes are the ones that are most recognizable because they bring an immediacy to the idea that this could happen here and show how we get from Trump's America related to Gilead with references that are all too recognizable, including Serena Joy, who's kind of been an updated character, Gilead's leader, who's talking about her book, A Woman's Place, over the noise of protesting college students, and June defending her choice to send her child to school sick or adapting to increased restrictions and refugees stopped at airports and checkpoints. For all its timeliness, I think its refusal to deal with the question of race is particularly both perplexing and disappointing. In the novel, there is a brief mention in a news report that the so-called, quote, children of Ham are being resettled to National Homeland One, justifying the absence of people of color in the novel. Given that much of the historical abuse upon which the novel is based, though, had women of color as its primary victims, it makes their erasure more than a little problematic. At the same time, including people of color in the TV series without actually addressing racism leads to incongruities that test the imagination. The idea that Gilead embodies every element of the repressive right in terms of gender, sexuality, and class, but somehow is colorblind, is the most unbelievable thing about it, and defies Atwood's own stated intent of not putting anything in her world that hasn't already happened. A right-wing repressive regime with its seat of power in Boston that's not racist is ahistorical and unbelievable. And it deprives the show of what some of could become its most politically relevant material, and means that some of the show's best talent, like Samira Wiley, is tragically underutilized. While there's much to gain, I think, in the show's updating of Atwood's novel, I also want to say, I think, up front that partly why some of the second season, I promise, I think there's, poster and definite robes, I think there's something problematic both artistically and politically about kind of these serialized dystopias. In a 1977 review of the original Star Wars movie, the great science fiction writer Samuel Delaney wrote about the limitations of movies like Brave New World in 1984, noting that there's a limit to how many times you can watch something when the filmmaker's intention is to show you a future in which things will be flat, uninteresting, repressive, and inhumanly dull. And I think this points to the danger of a serialized dystopian television extended for profit, not for artistic quality or political urgency. Its power lies really in its ability to think about and potentially change the present. Serializing that dystopia artistically is hard to sustain and creates a system of permanent political stagnation that negates, I think, much of its fictional power. In Atwood's novel, actually, the ending is one of the more interesting points, and it's kind of a spoiler alert, but not really. We never do know what happens to Offred or June. We do know that the regime of Gilead, though, is in the past, as Offred's narrative is the subject of a discussion at the, quote, 12th Symposium on Gileadian Studies, featuring a professor from the Department of Caucasian Anthropology and specialists in 20th and 21st century archives. What this does is it may leave Offred's fate unknown, but it also provides an ironic commentary on history as scholars study Gilead, comparing it to other repressive societies with an ironic detachment that both distances and comments on the proximity of such a world, leaving us with, the last line is a speaker asking for questions and leaving us with more of them. Handmaid's biggest competition has been Westworld, another dystopian tale based on Michael Crichton's 1973 movie about a theme park based on the worst of the Wild West mythology, with hosts, non-human machines who appear human and allow the guests to act out all their world's worst fantasies until the hosts develop the ability to defy their programming. It draws clearly on dystopian fiction, including Brave New World, and Huxley's novel Forward is God, because it's a society based on Taylorist production models, and one of the characters is Bernard Marx, who works in a department that uses psychological conditioning. The architect of Westworld is, of course, also a Ford, and Bernard plays an important role at times conditioning the park's hosts. I don't have time to talk much about it here, because I'm over time, but I did want to comment just on a couple things that I think are explain its political appeal. On first glance, it portrays a fairly cynical view of humanity, one in which humans, when given the choice, invariably choose narratives in the visual reality of Westworld that are violent, abusive, sexist, and generally lacking in any concern for others or morality. At the same time, these humans are almost all the super rich, and their abuse of the park's hosts and employees is due to their class position, I would argue, more than their humanity. And one of the strengths of Westworld occasionally, particularly in another second season that we could talk later about, are the moments of solidarity or potential solidarity between lower level employees and of Westworld and the hosts. And the question of class is one I wish that were explored more in this sense. Season one, though, of Westworld I thought was magnificent in many ways. While I was initially disturbed at the constant violence against women in the first few episodes, I think this was central. Ultimately, the first season functioned in many ways like an allegory for the Me Too movement, while also raising important issues of memory and consciousness that are central to dystopian fiction. Depicting women who are brutalized routinely in an entertainment industry where they are at the mercy of wealthy and powerful and then have their memory wiped and are reprogrammed so they can do it all again is a fitting metaphor for women in Hollywood in the Me Too era. The first season's most compelling narratives arcs are the coming of consciousness of Dolores and Maeve as once they are able to claim their experience, remember it, and learn from it, they are able to fight back. As Dolores remarks, those are all just roles you forced me to play. Under all these lives I've lived, something else has been growing. I've evolved into something new. The narrative loop that these women are caught in for most of season one become narrative devices to talk about trauma and speak to an experience all too common for women trapped in a seemingly endless cycle of abuse. And it's no coincidence, I think, that the leaders of the host revolt are women. It's worth saying that the show's resonance in the Me Too moment is further amplified by the fact that one of its stars, Evan Rachel Wood, and leader of the host rebellion, gave incredibly powerful testimony in front of Congress in February about her experience of multiple rapes, physical and emotional abuse in an attempt to expand the Sexual Assault Survivors Bill of the Rights, and has been very active in the Times movement. I think that unfortunately some of the season two has kind of put some of these women back into fairly stereotypical roles of the kind of avenging angel or maid who is powerful but singularly motivated by her desire to return to her role as a mother. To conclude, since I'm over time, I think one thing that's important is that central to both dystopias and alternate histories is the idea that memory, history, and consciousness matter. As socialists who understand one role of the Revolutionary Party to be the memory of the working class, this is something we can take from it. As one critic explains, the circumstances that create any brave new world simultaneously cauterize its edge and destroy memories of the world before. From a tyrant's point of view, memory, both personal and cultural, must be wiped as cleanly and quickly as possible. And I don't think it's a coincidence that one of the central themes of shows like Handmaid's Tale and Westworld is that it is what does it mean to become conscious? There's constant, the idea of being awake now. And this can be sometimes more or less, but I think it also insists on the need for political understanding of our past and present if we're to impact the future. It's why I don't agree that some articles recently that have said that dystopian fiction of the past used to be about resistance, but now it's about submission. Because a striking feature of all these dystopian worlds, part of the reason there's such extreme regulation of sexuality and relationships, is that that's where human connection, love, and solidarity is born. And no matter how much these are controlled, it always fails, even between humans and hosts. A common feature of dystopian fiction is that protagonists first rebel through some kind of illicit relationship, whether sexual or not. And it's through that they often begin to make connections that give them the confidence and motivation to resist the system as a whole. At the same time, it's in the nature of dystopian fiction that resistance is difficult, if not in some cases impossible. As one writer explains, by their nature, they are inescapable. A dystopia you can escape from is not a dystopia. It is the third hour of Love Actually. And I don't think this is inherently pessimistic, but it's about, because I think it is what, despite even the most monolithic repressive regimes, the fact that people can resist and do, whether they're successful or not, is what matters. In both Parable of the Sower and It Can't Happen Here, the same people who looked to the dystopic Trump-like demagogue also turn on him when they realize that he has not made their lives better and has in fact made them immeasurably worse. People can and do learn from their experiences and alternatives are possible. And this is why, despite the pall cast by their dystopic worlds at the heart of it, is the idea of the contingent in history, whether looking forward and backwards. These genres provide a space to wonder, imagine, question what alternatives exist and what our actions today and historically could mean for the future. As Octavia Butler writes about the Peril of the Sword, she says this was not a book about prophecy. Some time ago, I read someplace of three categories of science fiction stories, the what-if category, the if-only category, and the if-this-goes-on category, and I liked this idea. So this is definitely an if-this-goes-on story, and if it's true, if it's anywhere near true, we're all in trouble. In a recent article, Margaret Atwood says that the role of artists and writers in the current period is, quote, to create alternate words that offer both temporary escapes and moments of insight, to remind us in times of crisis or panic that each one of us is more than just a vote, a statistic. Lives may be deformed by politics, but we are not finally the sum of our politicians. And I think it's worth saying just quickly, there's a connection between people who read this fiction also and activists. It's a reason it's very popular among social justice activists today. One bookseller notes that what they notice is that people started off buying these classic dystopian books, but then moved to the activist section of the bookstore and were increasingly buying those kinds of books. And she said, well, what we know is we're in this dystopian, frightening world, but okay, what do we do about it? As the great late Ursula Gwynn says, we live in capitalism, its power seems inescapable, so did the divine right of kings. Any human power can be resisted and changed by human beings. Resistance and change often begin in art, and very often in our art, the art of words. And Octavia Butler plays a particularly important role in inspiring activists. If people haven't seen, there's a book called Octavia's Brood as a concrete example of this, a collection of short stories written by today's social justice activists in the movement, including an essay by Mamia Boudjamal, and it's gives a space for people active today to talk about the horrors of exploitation, war, oppression, and misery in the present and think about their struggles and the future they're fighting for in these stories. And I wanted to end with a quote that somebody wrote about. There was a kind of on what would have been Octavia's Butler. There was a series of what Because of Octavia tweets, and one woman wrote this: because of Octavia, I can imagine the worlds I cannot live without, just as I dismantle the ones I cannot live within. And I think this is the message that gets at the heart of the meaning of this work and our project of this conference. How do we take the dystopic visions of capitalism that it inspires and transform them into a future we want to live in?
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.